Welcome to Fire on the Prairie, the monthly radio show brought to you by In These Times magazine. I'm Emily Udell.
And I'm Aaron Sarver. On this episode, hear an interview with Chesa Boudin, co-editor of the new book, Letters from Young Activists.
For us, it's about finding an alternative. I think young people are deeply disillusioned with the exploitative nature of 21st century capitalism.
Also on this show, Aaron Sarver interviews journalist Glenn Ford about California workers' victory in a class action lawsuit against Walmart.
And you'll hear journalist Jessica Pupovac give us the latest on the Chicago Transit Authority's refusal of an offer of discounted diesel fuel from the Venezuelan government.
First up on Fire on the Prairie, a conversation with Glenn Ford. On December 22nd, an Oakland court ordered Walmart to pay $207 million to former employees named in a 2001 class action lawsuit. The court ruled that Walmart violated California state law by not allowing employees to take a 30-minute unpaid break during shifts longer than 6 hours. Aaron Sarver spoke with Black commentator publisher Glenn Ford about the case. Ford has written about Walmart for various publications.
How will this court decision affect Walmart?
Well, it will have a much more political impact than it will have a financial impact. We have to understand that Walmart is a $256 billion a year global revenue company. So the court judgment, even if it's affirmed on appeal, will not hurt the company. But it will signal that the political war is on, and at least at this stage, Walmart taking a blow. We have to really, however, consider how we look at this struggle. Walmart is the leader in the race to the bottom in terms of workers' wages and working conditions and actual relationship to their employers and society. But they're not the only ones. And if we don't get it in our heads in terms of cadre, that means the people who work with unions, and the workers in general, that this is a corporate charge, that the race is not just Walmart. There are other players in this race. In fact, all of the corporate players are in this race. Then we won't understand the circumstances of the game.
You've written extensively about Walmart. What do you think is the biggest misconception about Walmart in the public eye?
I don't know if it's a misconception. The public thinks that they get things cheap. Walmart's customers are low-income people in the main. Walmart's policies, and that also includes other corporations like Walmart, one must emphasize this, it's not just Walmart, will create more and more low-income people. So what we are seeing is the impoverization systematically by corporations like Walmart, and with Walmart in the lead, of whole communities that have less and less money and will need to go to cheaper places like Walmart more and more. They will have less and less options. Their world will shrink. Walmart, with its big boxes, shrinks the lives of working people.
Do you have any specific strategies in mind to combat Walmart and other corporations that are systematically working against labor practices?
Yes, Walmart started off in Bentonville, Arkansas, which is where their computers regulate everything that happens, which means that whatever happened in California that violated the rights of workers happened everywhere. Walmart has stores, but it rapidly became not a southern and southwestern corporation, but a national one. It's had problems getting into the big urban areas. What the Black commentator has been advocating for 2 years is that activists join in devising a plan for cities to save themselves from corporate penetration that allows corporations design not just the layouts of the cities, but the lifestyles and wage levels of cities. And that includes Walmart, but it's more than just Walmart. If we don't do that, if we don't resist penetration by not just the Walmarts, but by other corporations into our urban life, then we will face a demographic crisis that becomes a political crisis in which we cannot resist them.
What do you think are the chances of Walmart being unionized anytime soon in the U.S.?
Very little chance. And that the reason is, and I hope my union brothers and sisters will not resent this comment, because I believe that they do not understand that, I'm talking about my union brothers and sisters, I believe they do not understand that it is not just the big beastie, Walmart. Walmart is simply at the head of the pack. It's not just a model. It is where the whole system is going. And therefore, the resistance must be based upon changing the way business is done in the United States. For example, Walmart is the major domo of outsourcing. But it's not the only one. It's the most dramatic one. We know that Walmart is one of the major importers from China, but it's not the only one. We don't change conditions for working people simply by getting Walmart, and we don't change Walmart without an understanding of the overall situation. We have to get the broad scheme, and that's not being done by the unions. And historically, American unions have never taken a broad look at the global picture and seen themselves as in opposition to what capital does. If they do not do that, and I do not believe they are doing that now, then they will fail, as they have failed in the past.
You just heard an interview with Glenn Ford about the recent court ruling against Walmart. Ford is publisher of BlackCommentator.com.
Dear Dad, happy birthday. Although Clinton Max is one of the last places I would like you to celebrate turning 60, I take solace in the fact that your circumstances are largely a product of your own stubborn commitment to progressive political change and to the inherent value and equality of all human life. I deeply respect your commitment to your principles, your willingness to sacrifice yourself in the hopes of creating a better world for future generations of children, including me, your only son, even while staring a life sentence in the face. I'm proud of you for standing up for your anti-racist and anti-imperialist politics. However, your decisions had real human costs, including the murder of three fathers and husbands and the traumatic disruption of untold children's lives, my own among them.
That was Chase Boudin reading from a letter to his father, David Gilbert, in the new book Boudin co-edited titled Letters from Young Activists. When Boudin was just 14 months old, his father and mother, Kathy Boudin, participated in a robbery that resulted in the shooting deaths of three people. Neither was armed or involved in planning the robbery, but both went to prison. Kathy Boudin was released in 2003, but Gilbert won't be eligible for parole until 2056. Boudin was raised by Bernadine Dorn and Bill Ayers, who, like his biological parents, were members of the 1970s radical group The Weathermen. The 25-year-old Boudin is now a Rhodes Scholar, activist, and writer. He co-edited Letters from Young Activists, in which 50 activists, aged 10 through 31, speak to their predecessors, look critically at the movement itself, and send messages to future generations. Emily Udell recently sat down with Boudin at the offices of In These Times to talk about the book and youth activism.
When you conceived of a book project, when you and your co-editors conceived of a book project around youth and activism, why did you decide to use the medium of letters?
We chose letters because we wanted to make sure that activists from all different walks of life would be able to contribute. We felt that letters would be a format that anybody, no matter what their background, would be able to write. On the other side, we also wanted the book to be more accessible to readers. And we felt that letters would be a much more personal way of writing about political issues. A lot of academic writing tends to be very dense, filled with jargon, and very inaccessible to mainstream audiences. And the whole point of political organizing is to reach out to everybody.
What kind of issues specifically emerge from these letters that are different than the issues on the forefront of the movement in your parents' generation?
It really depends on the letter you look at. Most of the letters deal with pretty specific issues. The book as a whole deals with a hodgepodge, a really wide range of issues. We are dealing with some of the same issues my parents' generation was dealing with. For example, a huge part of their time and energy when they were my age was dedicated to fighting the war in Vietnam. Well, a lot of young people in this book are writing about their opposition to the war in Iraq. We have an entire chapter on the war on terrorism. We have a young Iraqi student who writes a letter to his family in Iraq about the occupation from in his perspective as an Iraqi American. So I think those issues are perhaps constant. Issues that are different, I think we have a lot of letters that look specifically at intergenerational dialogue and ways in which my parents' generation can be useful to us as mentors and as comrades, but without falling into the kinds of condescending or patronizing that is so common in dealing with the older generation. And I think my parents' generation did not do a particularly good job, for the most part, reaching out to the generation of activists that came before them in the 30s.
What do you think the special contribution that these young activists make in the context of the larger movement?
You know, any successful movement, any successful protest has to draw on the strength and on the diversity of the people that make it up. These young people that are in the book, just like young people all across the country who are doing important political work, are making their individual contributions, and they're thinking and they're grappling with difficult issues on a day-to-day basis. So to me, that, I think, is in some ways the most important thing, a commitment to a better world and a willingness to strive to live our lives in a way that does not make a mockery of our values. It's not an easy thing to do. And here you have 50 voices from young people all across the country who, in very different ways, are struggling to do that.
How would you respond to someone who says that the range of issues addressed by the activists in the book and the contradictions in ideas and approaches add up to sort of a cacophony, and that it's hard to see the future of the movement because it's so hard to find the common thread in all of these voices?
You know, I don't mind the word cacophony. I think that there's something good about it, actually. Certainly the best, most powerful protests I've been to have a blend of kind of the disciplined, you know, unity and calling out a common chant, and the randomness and arbitrariness of each person with their own sign and wearing their own clothes and their own political T-shirt and coming from their own part of the world and calling out their own issue. And I think that this book is a blend of those things, just like the best protests I've been to. This book has very, very different voices, talking about very different issues and coming from a very broad range of political perspectives. On the other hand, there is something that ties us together, and that is a commitment to fighting for a better world. And a better world defined, I think, not by any individual author, I think young people are deeply disillusioned with the exploitative nature of 21st century capitalism. We are struggling to find an alternative system, and I don't think that we're dogmatic. I don't think we've made up our minds. I don't think we know the exact or think we know the exact answers, but I think we're all committed to finding answers and to finding a different system in which we can respect the nature of our interaction with each other and with other countries around the world.
How has having four parents, your biological parents, Kathy Boudin and David Gilbert, and the parents who raised you, Bernadine Dorn and Bill Ayers, who are all icons of the old left, helped or hindered you in forming your own identity as an activist?
Certainly my experience, both growing up in a politically conscious household with politically conscious parents, and also visiting my parents in prison throughout my life, had a very profound impact on my own political perspective and personal development. I think I was lucky to grow up in a family and in a house where politics matter. Far too many people in the United States grow up in households that care much more about Britney Spears than they do about what's going on down the block in a local homeless shelter or in a juvenile detention center in their city. So I think for me, I was very blessed that I had a politically conscious household from the beginning. The other thing is that I have always had one foot in different worlds. Let me explain. I grew up in a white, upper middle class household. I went to private school. I was admitted to and able to pay my way through Yale. That has always been one reality for me. On the other hand, I've always had to go through a metal detector and steel gates to hug my parents. And that is also a reality for me. And I think it's the tension between those two very different worlds and that has had the most profound impact on my personal development. The tension, the exposure to two worlds that so rarely in this country come into interaction with each other.
What about in terms of feeling like you have to live up to some kind of standard that's been put out there by people in your family?
Yeah, I think my parents made plenty of mistakes. Certainly my parents in jail ended up spending most of their lives in prison for a reason, because they made very serious mistakes. All of my parents collectively and their generation of activists, as Bernadine, my adoptive mom, mentioned in the preface of Letters from Young Activists, left the world worse off, perhaps, than they found it. While they set an example of people who live their lives in a very principled way, of people who are willing to put their own lives on the line to fight for their vision of a better world. At the same time, they didn't have all that many major successes. There's a lot to live up to in terms of the commitment, in terms of commitment to social justice and in a principled lifestyle. But as far as the actual successes, I think there's plenty of room for improvement. And I'm still learning from them, and they're still working. It's not as though their lives as activists are over either. And it's been great to be able to work on something like this, with Bernadine. And also to engage my father, my biological father, David Gilbert, through my own letter in the book, which is addressed to him. So I think it's a complicated question, but I certainly don't see it as having to live up. I will say that if I wanted to go into the private sector, I might take a little fire from my family for that. But I haven't ever really thought about trying it. So,
as you just mentioned, you wrote a letter to your biological father, David Gilbert, who is serving time in Clinton Correctional Facility for his activism. What was it like to write that letter?
Well, the letter was originally written to my dad for his 60th birthday, and my mom and I had organized a bunch of his old friends and family to write letters to him to celebrate his 60th birthday in prison. At that point, I didn't even think about using the letter for this book, so it was a difficult thing to do because I obviously wasn't happy about having my father spend his 60th birthday in prison. I was in South America at the time. And over the next few months, as I was traveling through South America, ultimately ending up in Venezuela, where I spent most of last year doing work, I decided to use the letter for the book. And that then involved the process of rewriting and going through countless drafts, and also trying to dialogue with my father about the letter and about what aspects of our relationship he felt comfortable with me making public. So it was a difficult process, but it was one that I think for me has already been very rewarding. I think the process of writing, the exactness of the written word, is something that forces me as a writer to think very carefully about what I mean and how I express myself. And so it's helped me articulate very, very personal issues that before working on this project, I might not have been able to articulate.
Is there anything else that I haven't asked you about the book that you'd like people to know?
I think the most important thing is that it's a book that is rooted firmly not just in faith that another world, a better world, is possible, but also that young people can and will and inevitably must play a role in defining that future world. So I think people who want to know what's in store for the next 20 or 30 years better pick it up and find out.
Thank you very much, Chase Aboudin, for talking with me.
Thank you very much, Emily. It's been good to be here.
That was an interview with Chase Aboudin, co-editor of Letters from Young Activists. Boudin is also a translator of Understanding the Venezuelan Revolution and has a new book on Venezuela coming out in February. You're listening to Fire on the Prairie.
On December 28th, Jessica Pupovac's article about the Venezuelan government's offer of discounted fuel to the Chicago Transit Authority appeared in the online publication New Standard News. Aaron Sarver sat down with Pupovac to discuss the story and its continuing developments.
Can you tell us a little bit about what's going on with the program sponsored by the Venezuela government in New York and Boston?
Sure. Last September, when Hugo Chavez was in New York for the UN summit, he made a promise to the people of the South Bronx that the government of Venezuela would provide heating oil at discounted rates to help offset the rising costs of oil in the U.S. this upcoming winter. And he made the promise in the context of realizing how much disparity there was in the U.S. and making a statement that he wanted to do that kind of in an act of solidarity with low-income communities in the U.S. In the Bronx, CITGO signed a deal with three different community organizations that work in housing development projects or low-income housing projects. And then in Boston, they signed a similar deal with Citizens Energy Corp, which is an organization that helps deliver heating oil to low-income residents, mostly elderly residents in the Boston metropolitan area. These programs are currently underway. They've begun delivering the oil, and in most cases, the oil is being delivered directly to the housing projects, and then the residents are enjoying a reduced rent during the winter because most of the time they don't pay heating separate.
What is CITGO's offer to the Chicago Transit Authority?
CITGO made an offer last October to the CTA of 7.2 million gallons of diesel fuel at 40% off the current market value. And the estimates are that this could save the CTA $15 million. Part of the deal that CITGO is offering to the CTA requires them to pass these savings of $15 million on to Chicago's low-income residents in the form of either free or hugely discounted fare cards, which would be a huge help for people this winter, especially with rising heating costs and the simultaneous increase in CTA fares. They made this offer in very vague terms just to initiate the discussion and asked that the CTA consult with their technical advisors to find out exactly what the specifications of the diesel fuel that they require are and whether and how CITGO could procure those and how they would go about delivering them and everything like that. But the CTA, according to Martin Sanchez at the Consul General of Venezuela in Chicago, the CTA hasn't even given those specs to CITGO. CITGO is saying that they can provide the kind of fuel that the CTA requires.
The Chicago Transit Authority has turned down the offer from the Venezuelan government. What is their reason for turning down the offer?
The CTA has not officially turned down the offer to CITGO. They've turned down the offer in the media, but they have not responded to CITGO or the Venezuelan embassy directly. That's why a lot of local politicians feel that the question is still on the table, that there's still some chance of convincing the CTA to take them up on their offer. The CTA, however, is claiming that they cannot accept the offer because CITGO doesn't sell low sulfur diesel fuel in the Midwest. However, CITGO is saying that no, they don't sell low sulfur diesel fuel here in the Midwest because there isn't a demand for it, but they would be able to procure it if necessary.
So what do you think is the real reason that the CTA has turned down CITGO's offer?
Well, it's hard to speculate about why the CTA would make a decision to turn down so much discounted fuel when they're in the midst of a huge budget crisis that is, of course, causing them to raise fares for their riders. But according to WBBM, they have a written report on their website dated January 5th. Quote, Prusy has had reservations about dealing with CITGO because of the tensions between the Bush administration and the government of Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez, an unease that surfaced again Wednesday. End quote. So if that's what Prusy says, then, you know, I suspect that there's some politics that are coming into play in the CTA's decision to reject this offer.
A number of Chicago politicians really want this deal to happen. Can you talk about that?
Billy Ocasio in the 26th Ward actually kind of initiated this discussion. He has a special relationship with CITGO because they sponsored the Fiesta Boricua, the Puerto Rican Cultural Festival, in late summer when that festival almost didn't happen because they didn't have enough money. CITGO stepped forward as an act of solidarity with the Latino community of Chicago and provided the funding. When Alderman Ocasio heard of CITGO's initiatives in New York and Boston, heard that they actually wanted to begin those programs here in Chicago, he contacted the CITGO officials and said, you know, let me help. What can I do? Let's get this on the table. Let's get this conversation started. So he has been an integral part of trying to push this forward. Representative Luis Gutierrez has also spearheaded, along with Ocasio, a coalition of different community organizers and activists and politicians who are pushing for the CTA to accept CITGO's offer. And Gutierrez was basically saying that he can't understand a government agency that's so short on funds and is going down to Springfield every year with its hat in its hand asking for more money because of what he was calling poor fiscal management, how such an agency could turn down an offer like this. But he basically said, you know, if the people of Venezuela want to give this public gift, then Frank Prusy needs to step out of the way and let this happen.
That was an interview with freelance journalist Jessica Pupovac. To read her story about the Venezuelan government's offer of discounted fuel to the CTA, visit newstandardnews.net.
Thanks for joining us for Fire on the Prairie, the monthly radio show sponsored by In These Times magazine. Visit In These Times on the web at inthesetimes.com.
Check out our archived shows and sign up for our news updates and podcast at fireontheprairie.com.
Fire on the Prairie is produced by Aaron Sarver and Emily Udell in Chicago.
We hope you've enjoyed this edition of Fire on the Prairie, and please join us again next month.